Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is former Taylor Swift manager, Rick Barker. But first of all, the record labels are beginning to change their strategy and how they market their artists. And this is a big deal because up until now, the way it worked was you released an album, and for a period of 2 weeks to maybe 2 months, the label was hot on it. And then if it wasn't selling, they sort of forgot about you and went on to the next product. Now, the problem with this is the fact that if you're not getting traction right away, they'll forget about you. No problem. But as we all know, there are many, many examples of a record catching fire, an album catching fire gradually as more and more people find out about it, as the act tours, as maybe it starts to get traction on radio in some places. Well, that happens less and less these days, so the labels are taking notice, and they also realize that there's no purchase journey, as they would call it. In other words, they're not selling a product any longer. They're selling engagement. And the labels are looking at other industries. They're looking at the publishing industry, for instance. They're looking at the hotel industry. And they're looking at how those agencies engage their particular clients. Well, as a result, what is going to happen is you're going to see the marketing departments, especially at the major labels, begin to change their strategy in how they're marketing their artists. So no longer are they worried about what they would call the release window. The release window is the album gets released, and from anywhere from a 2 week to a 2 month or 3 month period, the label is marketing hard. They're working it really hard. And if there's any indication within that period that all of a sudden public interest is going away and the sales are going down, then they're off to the next product. Well, again, we're not talking about selling products at this point because the sales are down for just about everybody. If your name isn't Adele, that is. And as a result, in order for the music business to really get back to where it was before, it has to change completely how it thinks. And that's beginning to happen. So what we're seeing is the change from a product model. In other words, labels have products, to an engagement model where they're thinking more about long-term engagement of an artist's fan base. So now what you're going to find is they're going to be working the records longer. They're going to be working singles. They're going to be working albums longer because it behooves everybody if there's a what they call a continuous loop. And that's a continuous loop of people listening and listening and listening over again because everybody gets paid the more you listen. So this has really changed the outlook of the industry. It took long enough, but finally they're understanding that they have to get with the program. They have to think with the way the business is going. And thankfully, the major labels are. Now, this is started by Sony, actually, and started in the UK, but you're going to see this happen worldwide. All the labels are going to catch on to this because they really have to. They have to change their strategy in order to maintain their position. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I just launched a new mini coaching program. It's called Lead and Background Vocal Mixing Tricks, as well as an upcoming mixing workshop where I'll personally help you with your mixes. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is the fact that super producer, legendary Sir George Martin passed away this last week. And so much has been written about him, said about him, and rightfully so, he was a hugely influential music producer and person. If it wasn't for him, the Beatles never would have gotten anywhere because they were turned down by multiple labels, and George was the only person to take a chance on them. So right there, that's something special. But the fact that he helped them grow, he pioneered different production methods and was entirely creative, that's pretty amazing. The fact of the matter is he changed the music business on a much deeper level, on a financial level. And not many people understand this. I wrote about it in a Forbes article in this last week. In case you haven't read that, let me just go over what happened. George Martin was a staff engineer for Parlophone, which was an EMI subsidiary. Now, in those days, music producers didn't get a royalty. They got a salary. They were a salaried staff person. And George Martin was no exception. Now, George was making EMI lots of money before he found the Beatles. But when he found the Beatles, it was a huge, huge cash cow. So much so that it's been said that they were making $1 billion a year just off the Beatles. Now, I can't verify that, but I've heard from pretty good sources they were making huge amounts of money. And we're talking 1964, 1965, 1966. Well, to make a long story short, here we go, where the only thing George can hope for instead of a royalty is a bonus at the end of the year. And 1 year after the Beatles were more successful than ever, where they had number one after number one worldwide, George was denied a bonus at the end of the year. And here's a guy that's pulling all sorts of money in for the company, and they won't even give him a bonus. So what George did is he took the major step of going out on his own, becoming independent. And he was the first independent record producer. So what ended up happening there is suddenly he was able to take advantage of advances. He was able to get royalties on the things he worked with. And of course, that prompted a lot of other successful producers to do the same thing and follow in his footsteps. So that changed everything right there. But it changed yet another time afterwards, because the record labels looked at this and they said, wait a second, this is actually working in our favor. So what they did is they eliminated the staff position of producer. And they basically said, okay, all you guys are on your own from now on. Now, what happened there was all of a sudden the record label didn't have to worry about the overhead of another person on the payroll. But they took the next step and they said, okay, from now on, we're not going to pay the royalty to the producer. We're not going to pay the advance to the producer. It's up to you, the artist, to pay all that. So now there's even less money coming out of the record label coffers. And until this day, artists pay for the producer. If there's an advance that goes to the producer, that comes out of the artist's advance. If there's a royalty, and usually the royalty is 3% or so, that comes out of the artist's royalty. So George Martin, I'm sure, didn't want to start that part of the business, but in fact he did. So that's the bad part in terms of artists are concerned. Again, the good part is the fact that once he started out as an independent producer, the rest of the production world followed him, and that was a great step in the right direction. But as it always happens, record labels tend to find a way to make everything work in their favor, and in this case, that's no exception. So thank you, George Martin. Thank you for the great music that you worked on. Thank you for the records that you produced. Thanks for being a great gentleman. And as a producer, I thank you for some of the money that I've made. My guest today is Rick Barker, who went from DJ to label promo man to Taylor Swift's manager during her early career. Rick is now a consultant in social media for American Idol and teaches people how to navigate the music business with his Music Industry Blueprint course. I spoke with Rick from his studio in Nashville. Rick, tell me how you got into the business in the first place. How one gets into the music business is there's never a typical path.
You know what? You're exactly right. I've always been told there's no two stories who are ever the same. I wasn't talented enough to be a singer. I loved music. I just wasn't that guy, you know, but I always had a knack for promotion. So I started off as a mobile DJ back in Alabama. And my passion and my goal at that time was one day I'm going to be on the radio. I wanted to be like Rick Dees. I wanted to be like Wolfman Jack. I wanted to be on the radio. And that was my goal. Casey Kasem, here I come. You know, that was it for me.
You have that kind of voice, actually.
Well, it worked. I ended up on the radio. My career in music, I had a 15-year career. Did my whole entire radio career in Santa Barbara. And that's where I was introduced to country music. Started a country music station in 2001. Realized that, wow, I knew who Johnny Cash was, and I grew up in Alabama, so I figured I was as qualified as anyone else in California to start a country station. But that's where I fell in love with that style of music. That's where I really started understanding the economics and how the business worked. And I started creating, you know, programs that help solve problems. I realized early on, if you could become a problem solver, you would never be out of work, and ended up creating a little touring model to help independent artists and newer artists in their journey. Caught the eyes of Scott Borchetta, and next thing you know, he hires me to work at Big Machine Records, and 6 months later sends me this little 16-year-old named Taylor Swift and said, teach her radio, and we spent 30 days together that changed both of our lives and went on to managing her, and the rest is kind of history at that point.
Well, I want to get into that in a little bit, but first of all, tell me what you did at Big Machine.
I was a regional promoter, so my responsibility was I had 9 states and about 80 radio stations that I was responsible in developing relationships. My job was to get our artists played on those radio stations. So I would travel and get as much FaceTime with these folks as I could, learn as much about them as I could, develop those relationships. So as we get ready to need radio play for our artists, that relationship was set up, and I would help create promotions for them and, facilitate meet and greets whenever our artists were out in a certain part of the country. You know, early on, Jack Ingram was out with Brooks and Dunn, and Taylor was out with George Strait and all these things. So it's just building relationships with radio and really getting to understand how that worked. Coming from radio, that was an easy transition for me. I knew what their wants were. I knew what their needs were, and I was able to fulfill those.
So Taylor came to you then. She was already signed to Big Machine. And
she was.
And she came to you. You were doing promotion with her then? I assume she was doing a West Coast swing and you were with her?
She was. Yeah. The first single that we released on Big Machine Records was Jack Ingram. It was called Wherever You Are. It was his first single and our first number one as a label. So as we're getting towards the end, almost reaching number one, Taylor was next in line. So Scott sent her to me to teach her and help her understand radio. We went out and did radio visits where you go into a conference room and play your songs and introduce them to the program directors and the music directors. And I needed to get more experience for her in performing in smaller venues. So I had created a tour called the Nashville to You Radio Tour. If you couldn't get to Nashville, we'd bring Nashville to you, and took out Little Big Town and Sugarland and a lot of these bands early on. So I had this group of radio stations throughout California. As you know, you can go up the 101, cut across, and come down the 5.
Yeah,
Like real easy to get to these stations. So that's what we did. We went to these stations, introduced her, taught her the lingo, helped her understand the business, helped her build her own relationships. And then the family and Scott ended up coming to me saying, look, she needs a manager. She loves what you've been doing with her. And I ended up, my first gig as a manager was being part of the team that launched her. So that was fun.
How old was she at the time?
She was 16.
Wow.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is you can see talent early on. And they say this about basketball players, for instance, when they're really young, you can still see if they're going to be superstars when they're 13 and 14. And it's the same thing with music. There's a light that kind of shines out that's different from everybody else.
You're right. And I think also, too, as you identify early on who has that work ethic, those 13 and 14 year olds that go on to be superstars are the ones that stay after and shoot extra free throws. They're the ones that are going to every clinic that they can. Not every 13 or 14 year old who has talent does that. That's why not many of them end up in the NBA. The same, I think, is true for artists, is that all of them can sing. That's why they're here. But then you find that one that's that great writer that's really worked on their craft. And then they really focus on the business and they really want to understand their fan. Most artists are just okay with writing, creating music, getting on the radio, touring a little bit, having a great time. That's a good life for them. Very few have that work ethic that it takes to go to that next level. There's very few Jay-Z's. There's very few Taylor Swift's. There's very few Bonos, Madonna's, Paul McCartney's, those iconic artists that have gone on, Prince, that really understand everything that goes on with their business and treats it truly like a business. And that's why we don't have a lot of superstars.
But Taylor took the promotion right away, though.
She did. She did. She's always been one to see opportunity. She's always been one to want to learn. I always say you never stop learning. Experts and the best of the best, they never stop learning. She never stopped learning. I mean, she spent a lot of time getting to know who her audience was. And that's where a lot of businesses make the mistake as well, not just artists or anything else, is they don't really understand who their their fan is. You know, I think Apple does it better than everyone. They know exactly what we want, where hell, they'll get a 48-year-old guy to camp out at 3 o'clock in the morning for the next iPhone.
Yeah, yeah. I've done it.
They've done their homework. Taylor has done the same thing, in my opinion. She knows what her fans want. So they anticipate this record. They anticipate everything that she does. And it's been fantastic to watch. I mean, I left Taylor in 2008, and my gosh, she's just exploded since then. And it's fun to watch from this side too.
Why did you leave Taylor?
It was just too much for me. You know, I was living in California at the time, managing her. I was gone 187 days, my last year with her. In 2007, I had a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old at the time. And I'm like, all right, God, I'm about to make more money than I've ever made in my life. But at what expense? Alimony, child support. Will their kids know their dad? I grew up poor, so I've never made decisions based on money. And it's just not what I wanted to do in this business, was to be gone from my family. It was great. I learned a ton. I enjoyed it. But I just wasn't cut out for that. That wasn't the right thing for me. I love the artist development side. I love the teaching side. I hate the organizational management side. I honestly do. I mean, I want to help the artists fulfill their dreams. I don't want to make sure that all 20 moving parts are working the way that they're supposed to work. I like that more one-on-one relationship, that more building side of things. I did not like the overall job of what a manager was.
Yeah, it's so intense. I mean, there's, as you say, there's so many moving parts that are going on at any one time, and you're responsible for them all. So that
you are, it's intense. It works great. It's the label and the artist who did it. And when it screws up, it's the manager who did it. Yeah. You know, that's just the business. But I remember having that conversation with Irving Azoff one time. It's even for the biggest of the bigs. You know, it's, you've really got to, in this business, I think, find where you succeed and do well at and focus on it. There's a lot of mediocre people in this business. And I say that respectfully, but it's because they're trying to do everything. They're trying to wear so many hats that they don't, you know, succeed at one portion really well. I wanted to succeed at my role really well. There are amazing creatives here in Nashville. They don't need Rick Barker to jump in on the creative process. So I said, great, you guys create it. I'll help you get rid of it. I'll help you find an audience. I'll help you get in as many conversations as you can to share your stuff. That's my role. That's what I do very, very well. And that's what I've spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money learning how to do, was to get good at my part.
Well, let's talk about that. So you left Taylor, which is a big decision, especially when you have an artist like that, that you know is going to go on to greatness, but understandably why you, I understand completely why you did it. But that being said, did you have the next phase in mind, or were you just saying, okay, I'll figure it out as soon as things slow down?
Kind of a little bit of both. At the time, I was still living in Santa Barbara. So I knew that if I could get to Nashville, I could make something work for myself. So I ended up getting a call from Joe Galani's assistant at Sony at the time, Donna. And Joe was heading up Sony Music. And I didn't really know Joe. Joe was at the time the most powerful man in Nashville. You know, him and Scott come from two different worlds. Joe comes from an accounting background. Scott comes from a promotional background in the record side of things. And Joe had asked when the next time I was going to be in Nashville, wanted to take me to lunch. And I went out to lunch with Joe, the most fascinating lunch that I'd ever been involved in. Started asking me a lot of questions and offered me a job as a consultant. I didn't even know what a consultant did. I remember excusing myself to go back to the restroom, calling my wife, going, hey, go to Google and type in, what does a consultant do? I've been offered this job as a consultant. She said, well, they advise in areas of expertise and it looks like they get paid pretty well. So I went back and said, you know what? I'd love to be a consultant. And that ended up being a 3.5-year consulting role for me until Joe ended up leaving. And I was able to learn a lot about the business. I was able to see the inner workings of the record company outside of just the promotion side. I was able to see where I felt a lot of the balls were being dropped. I was seeing a lot of different things. And in the back of my mind, I didn't realize at the time I was going to create solutions for these problems. You know, at the time, we felt that, you know, we had to do all the social media for the artist and we had to do this. And all they had to focus on was the creative process. And what I realized early on is we were creating monsters. You know, there were a lot of artists that didn't even know how to engage with their fans because they weren't doing it. It was the PR departments and things like that. So I learned a lot of lessons in that that I've been able to take into my new venture, which has been going on now for about 3 years, to be able to say, okay, there was no one teaching artists how to be artists in this new music business. So that became my role. So working with Sony was great. I stayed on consulting Big Machine Records. I ended up doing some consulting for Live Nation on the merchandise side. Artists were hiring me to go out on the road. One of the things I do really well is help artists talk to bigger audiences and how to get people to the merch booth. I've always been a good communicator in that way with helping the artists relate. But I think that all goes back to I also was a coach. You know, I coach collegiate soccer. I've always been involved in building teams and coaching teams and working with people to get the best and most out of them. And that's what's always been the core of who I am as a teacher, is I think I've always been a coach.
And you do it well, especially now in your new role at rickbarker.com, where you have a number of courses specifically for musicians to solve their problems. And let's face it, musicians, as you said, they love to create. They're really good at it. But a lot of them could care less about the rest of the business.
Sure. And that's okay if that's what your goals are. Yeah. You know, but if your goals, I always tell people when we sit down together and I start working with someone, I said, tell me what your goals are. And almost all of them, Bobby will say, I want to play to arenas. You know, it's like, great. Well, what's it going to take? Well, great songs. Well, yeah, but it's also going to take people, you know? So in order to fill an arena, you're going to have to start building a lot of relationships right now. You're going to have to start getting your music in front of a lot of people. You're going to have to start getting people where they just can't wait to see you. I always bring up the Grateful Dead because I love that model. I love to share it, especially when people nowadays go, you can't give music away. It'll kill the business. The Grateful Dead have been giving away music since the 70s, and they would encourage you to record it. They would set up great little places where you could get the best sound to record your cassette. And then they wanted you to go share that with all of your friends so that when they came back 3 months later, you all could sing along to songs you knew and get high together and have fun.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great business model and still is a great business model. So what I try to do with that is I say, okay, what was the Grateful Dead's goal? To create an experience that other people wanted to share, to create music that other people wanted to share. So when you sit down with a new artist and you say, okay, what is your goals? Well, I want to be on the radio. Okay, well, let's just talk about the numbers. You know, 10 labels, 10 artists, that's 100 people at a time per genre of music. The internet has shown us there's thousands of more talented people. So why don't we do everything we can? Why don't we start with trying to get as much music on everyone's phone as we possibly can? Because for most of us, that is our radio now. We have access to music whenever we want it. Whatever emotion we're feeling will go to that genre of music, that style of music, that playlist that we've created. So I really work with artists to say, look, get yourself on a playlist. Let's start there.
Yeah.
Let's get people wanting to hear your music. And the cool part about having a website where I could organize all of it is I was always taught that those who solve problems are never out of work.
Yeah.
And people will always seek out folks who want to get their problem solved. I mean, you know, I wanted to learn more about social media for music, so I ended up buying a cool book. And it's called Social Media Promotion for Musicians by you, you know? And it was a great way for me to say, okay, Rick, if you're going to start teaching this, why don't you go learn from somebody who's created something and put it in that style? I'm not a writer. I'm more of a video guy. So it's like having resources like that available for the musician, I think is huge. And you were one of the pioneers in that. So I'm just kind of following in the footsteps of those that have come before me, utilizing the tools that are now available and investing in myself to learn as much as I can, to learn how to become a better delivery person of the content. There's a lot of people that would love to know what's going on, but there wasn't a lot of people who are actually working in the business today, like I am, that were out there willing to teach it because they get so caught up in what's going on a daily basis. I said, okay, I'm going to make this a part of what I do. This is going to be who I am.
How did the music industry blueprint come about?
The music industry blueprint came about is I read a book called The Millionaire Messenger from Brendan Burchard. And it said, make a difference and make a living sharing your knowledge and experience with others. So I was like, okay, wait a minute. I've been in this business for over 25 years. I'm one of the few people that has been a radio person a manager, worked at a record company, done over 200 tour dates. I might have something that people want to share. And then I started seeing all these kids paying for these music business degrees at these universities. And I'm not putting any of them down, but they were learning a lot of theory. And then I would see them and the things that they should be taught, they weren't being taught. There were a lot of parents coming to me that had questions and they all kept asking the same questions. So I said, I wonder if I could put this in a way where I could teach them, I could become part of that education for them. But the one thing that I really had to get people over was the fact that I was a manager, because they felt that I should just get involved with every artist that I like and work for free. And if the artist made money, then I would make money. And the problem with that is that most artists don't ever make money. Secondly, I can't control their work ethic. I can only control mine. And third, I know the work I'm going to put in. It's all mostly on the front end.
Yeah.
There may never be a back end. So I said, okay, they're willing to pay a vocal coach for time. They're willing to pay a guitar teacher for time. They're willing to go in the studio and pay for that time. They're willing to pay their attorney for their time and their knowledge and their experience. Why wouldn't they pay me for my knowledge and experience? But what I had to do was I had to first become credible in their mind. I had to become an expert in their mind. And I had to do a lot of free teaching and free webinars and free workshops to show them that, wow, this guy knows his stuff. And man, if that's what he's given us for free, I can only imagine what's in his program. So that's how the Music Industry Blueprint came about. The very first modules was funny. I went to a buddy of mine who's the A&R at Sony and a legal attorney here and a publisher. And I said, look, I'm going to do a live event. I'll pay you guys $500 for an hour of your time, but I get to record it and I get to put it up on this website. They're like, all right, cool. Can we do it next week too? You know, they were paid $500 for an hour. They loved it. And that's kind of how it started. And then I've just kept building more courses, solving more problems, adding as the business changes, which it does. I'm constantly updating my modules, because unlike having to send out a new DVD or a new CD every time something changes, I could just go record a new video, upload it on the website, and it's instantly there for them. Yeah. So I love the whole technology side of things.
So is that a subscription or are you buying it?
I have both. I have a subscription model, which is called the Music Industry Syndicate. And that is a way for me to do group coaching, where we come on and I'll usually teach for the first 15, 20 minutes. Like, for example, I have a call this Sunday. This Sunday, I'm going to teach them how to use two new apps that are out there that I really like. One is to work with their Instagram. Another one's called Know Me, which is kind of like a Snapchat iMovie kind of situation. That's really, really cool. I'm also going to teach them some of the Crowdfire stuff that is will allow you to follow more people on Twitter and Instagram and schedule your stuff. So I usually teach for the first 15, 20 minutes. And then I go through and I go in and I say, okay, what's going on in your business that I can help you with today? So I help them. What I learned early on, Bobby, is not everyone needed a manager. Most couldn't afford it. What they needed was advice and guidance. What they needed was a place to be able to bounce their ideas off or be told if they're doing the right thing. So that's what I created there. So I've got that program. My Blueprint membership is a lifetime program. And that one, they get in and I teach brand, how to build your brand, how to build your audience, how to engage your audience, how to sell. That's kind of like the education side of things. Social media for music is probably the best thing I ever did. It's videos, step by step, click by click. I share my screen. I have a video that walks them from setting up their Twitter, their Instagram, their YouTube, their Snapchat. I teach them how to use the automation features. After that program, everybody goes, well, that's great. I know how to use it, but how do I get more followers? So I created the 30-day music marketing challenge where I drip them every day, step by step, follow this many people, comment on this many posts, do this, do this, do this. We're about to launch phase two of that, which is more engagement. Everything I teach is about engagement. I had a developer develop a WordPress theme for me called the Musician's Theme. I couldn't find a theme that I really thought just had everything that it would need, from big social media icons to a music player to an opt-in form. I had to teach artists what opt-in forms were, the importance of getting emails and things like that. So I just keep creating. You know, I've got a lot of things in the pipeline, but whenever I do so much teaching that I hear their frustrations, and then I say, okay, how can I solve their frustrations for $27?
How can
I solve their frustrations for $47? Because I'll put in the time and the energy and the hours to create it. And I just want to make it affordable for these folks to give them access to someone like me.
Okay. What are the major frustrations that you are seeing out there? Some of them remain the same and some of them change. And I'm just curious, what are you seeing now?
The biggest frustrations is that we're trying to function in a dysfunctional business. Usually your rewards are in direct proportion to the work that you put in. And that's not happening. Every A&R person at a record label has something different. You're seeing kids get signed with no social media following. You're seeing people get signed with huge social media following.
Yeah.
You're seeing people get signed doing nothing but YouTube cover videos, and you're seeing people signed doing nothing but original. I mean, there is no right answer for anything. It's what I always tell people is your job is to be prepared for whatever opportunity might come your way. Biggest frustration right now is that artists are needing to do a lot of the development themselves. I think that's a strength. I don't think that's a weakness. I think that's a good thing because you can control the content. You can control what goes out. You don't have to ask anybody permission. A lot of the frustrations the artists had is they thought that if they spend time on social media learning to build their fans and their relationships, that that would take away from their creative side. And I'm showing them that that's not the case, that they're able to do it. I'm also loving the fact that right now most people are complaining because there's not enough gigs that are available to pay them. And the only reason you need to be paid when you do a gig is if you're traveling or you got a band to pay or anything like that. But with tools like Periscope and things like that, you could do a show right from your house that costs you nothing to do and be in front of hundreds of people and a very captive hundreds of people and give them the opportunity to buy your shirts and buy your merchandise. And you're not having to, you know, worry about how many people showed up at the club and if you're going to get that gig again. So teaching the artist how to use the tools that are available to them is very important for me right now, because you can wake up in the morning and create a song, record the song, shoot a video, get it in front of your audience, use your social media as your own PR firm, put it up on iTunes through TuneCore or CD Baby, or hell, you can sell it directly through PayPal and get paid in a day and never have had to ask anybody for permission to do that. I love that. A lot of people don't understand yet why that's to love. And that's my goal, is to help share that with
you. I know a lot about social media, but you've passed me by. You ran by me at 1,000 miles an hour, which is cool. I really enjoy that. And I learned, just talking to you the other day, a couple of things about Periscope, for instance. You feel Periscope is very powerful right now, right? As a social media tool.
I do. And why is because it's instant. Because Twitter bought Periscope, now your Periscope will open up right inside your Twitter account. You never have to leave unless you want to do this, but you can instantly get your message to people in real time. You know, before, you would send out a PR release. You would hope that the person saw it. You would hope that that person felt it was worthy to share with their people. You would hope that they would post it on their Facebook page, or they would include it in their article that came out at 5 o'clock that night. Right now, I can take my phone and instantly be communicating with the world in a matter of seconds. That's powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's very powerful. Any message that I want, if all of a sudden, if I'm an actor and somebody was talking, you know, oh my gosh, this actor did this, I could instantly go on Periscope and say, you know what, guys, here's what you're going to see in the trades, but let me tell you straight from me how it went down.
Yeah.
What happened? That's awesome. You know, as we've learned, though, social media can also get you in trouble instantly, but it can also protect you instantly. But I just love the fact that when I have them and they've made the decision to watch me, they're engaged with me at that time. I can control them. I can say, listen, do this. Tap your screen. Do me a favor. Share this. By the way, I'm only offering this to the next 10 people. Go here. I mean, for an artist to be able to walk somebody and say, hey, I'm going in the studio to lay down vocal tracks today. Come with me.
Yeah, all right.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, that's access. You know, I wear a shirt that says music has value. Scott Borchetta has brought that up. I think access has value. I think exclusivity has value. I also think scarcity has value.
Yeah.
You know, it's like getting people to react at certain points in times, but I absolutely love it. What I'm teaching the American Idol kids, I'm the social media mentor for Idol, is I get with them and I say, look, this is your $10 million commercial. You're never going to be as popular as you are right now at this particular point in time. How do you take advantage of that? How do you draw those people from TV to your Facebook to here? I've got a mom texting me back and forth right now going, how do I get more engagement on my Facebook page? I said, do a Facebook chat. Like, well, how do you do that? I said, go in and ask a question. And as soon as they first answer, tell them you're going to be in there for the next hour answering questions.
Yeah.
You can have a longer conversation than you could on Twitter. I don't know anyone who can build a relationship in 140 characters, but Facebook lets you talk longer. Facebook also rewards you for answering your comments faster. So the next time you post something, they'll let more people see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the fun part.
Okay. What, out of all the social tools, what do you feel is the most powerful right now and the most essential to an artist?
Twitter and Periscope, because they're connected. Mm-hmm. I think they're the most important right now. I also think, I always tell people, it's like, while you and I have been on this call, Bobby, and talking and doing this podcast, there's probably been five more apps and five more social media platforms that have shown up. Yeah. You know, that's how fast things are coming along. So I tell them, I said, you want to be where your audience is. Older people are coming on to Twitter now because all the television stations are training them. Join us with this hashtag. You know, every hashtag that you see on a television show right now, and every single, hell, the news even has hashtags
yeah,
now.
Right.
They're getting people to utilize Twitter. Twitter's about, you know, 400 something million people. But Facebook, out of the 1.8 billion people that are online, Facebook has 1.15 billion. It's still the granddaddy of them all. So I teach people how to use all of those sparingly. But for me, Twitter and Periscope are what I use on a daily basis. I'll go into Facebook to check on friends. I mean, I have posts scheduled to go out and things, but what I actually use the most is Twitter and Periscope.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you see the music going, Rick? Music business going?
Depends. What side of the business are you talking about? There's so many sides of it. I think touring's going to continue to do great. I think radio playlists are just going to continue to get tighter, which is unfortunate. But I think that, you know, what people have to understand, in my opinion, is that music is the tool which gets them into your world. There's a much bigger markup on a t-shirt than there is a download. There's a much bigger markup on a ticket to a show than there is a download. I think that the artists that are coming up right now can't try to be the next Taylor Swift or the next Beyonce or the next Jay-Z. They need to be the first them. They need to understand that if they're trying to follow the social media practices of the superstars, they're doing it wrong, because they don't have to follow everyone right now. You as a new artist should be following everybody who has acknowledged you, because if you don't, someone else will.
Yeah.
So I think that the music business, there's always going to be music, which is great. I hope we get it figured out where the songwriters could start getting paid the way that they're supposed to be paid. I think that there's not enough of that. I think part of my role this year is to help educate the consumer. I don't think the fans of the artists understand why they need to download a song or why they need to do this, because they know they can pay $10 a month and hear everything that they want on a Spotify or a Pandora or an iTunes radio. What they don't understand is it's really hard to pay back the bank, which are the labels, when we're dealing in fractions of a penny versus dollars. So I think they need to understand that. I think we did a terrible job as an industry of educating the consumer on why it is we need these things. I think while artists are just still showing photographs on social media of them courtside and driving these cool cars, then you tell somebody, hey, you know, don't give that song away. They're like, well, you're doing fine.
Yeah, it doesn't
work.
You
know, I just think there's a mixed message, and I want to help fix that message.
You know, it's interesting, though. I always ask the students when I go and speak in front of a university or a college or wherever, and I always ask them, okay, so tell me what social media platforms you're on. Tell me what streaming networks you're on. And tell me how many of you use iTunes to download things. And I'm always shocked at the number of students, and this is good, actually, it's a good thing, that say, well, I still use iTunes and I still download. So, well, wait a second, you just told me you're on Spotify and you're paying a subscription for Spotify. Why are you doing that? And usually it's, I want to support the artists. So
good.
There's that sentiment out there, which I think is really healthy. They understand it to a degree, maybe inherently, that they have to do more.
Sure.
So,
sure.
And again, you know, I have a small sample size, but I do ask everywhere I go, and I go a lot of places around the country, but it's changed. It's changed in the last year. Right.
Well, it has. And I think with a lot of this younger artist is that their fans will never not know Spotify or iTunes. You know, it's like they don't remember having to physically go to the store to buy a CD. So we have to educate them. I tell the artists that I work with, I said, bottom line, you're in the $1.29 friend business. You need to maintain a relationship where your friends feel obligated to give you $1.29. And if they don't, you're not as good a friend with them as you think you are. And you need to increase your skill level at maintaining relationships. And then you need them to complete the purchase a year from now. But the problem with most artists is they only show up to the fans when they need something. The only time they're communicating with the fans is to share an event on Facebook about a show they're doing. Not many of them have learned how to ask questions. Not many of them have learned how to engage in conversations. That's one of the things we focused on in the first music marketing challenge, was just getting them to follow other people and start commenting on other people's stuff.
Yeah.
Not even tell them that you're in the music business. Get them used to seeing you show up and give a crap. And then the next phase, we're going to start introducing the music and the lyrics and, you know, utilizing SoundCloud and all those tools. So what I think artists really need to do right now is start early on in that relationship, educating them, training them, letting them understand that they're having a bad day. You know, let them understand, you know, I'm going in the studio to do this, and it would mean a lot when it's done if you guys were able to pick it up on iTunes. You know, you can support me in that way and not be ashamed to tell someone you need help.
Yeah, right.
It's like there's some taboo against telling people, hey, I need you to buy this. So they'll ask for votes for contests. I've seen artists have zero problems with that. But when it's, I need you to come out and buy my music and support my music, and here's why, that's where I think we're missing the boat.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you there. Last question. So what's the best piece of business advice that you either learned along the way or maybe someone imparted to you?
Sure. Scott Borchetta taught me early on, start it crazy and work backwards. One of the things that, and it kind of tied in with a philosophy that I had always had, was weird wins. And the reason that weird wins is because 98% of folks won't get out of their comfort zone. So that means that if I'm willing to get out of my comfort zone, I only have to outwork 2%. I like my odds with that. I always say, you know, that's it. Start it crazy and work backwards. When I had an idea to do this, a lot of people said it was crazy. They said, no, you should just go out and find the next artist. Well, then I'm at the mercy of their success in order to provide for my family. I wanted to find a way that I could be in the business that I love, where I could provide a service. And because I'm able to provide that service, I'm able to then provide for my family. So I did start it crazy and I worked backwards. And every day I'm doing weird things, you know, and it's suited me well. It really has.
I've asked this question from 100 other people because this is 101. This is podcast number 101, actually.
Woo-hoo! Yes, there we go.
Yeah. And no one has ever come close to an answer like that. That's great.
Is that a good
I love
thing
it.
Or a bad thing?
No, no, that's great. That's great. I love it. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Rick. I knew it would be, and I knew I would learn a lot, as I always do, from you and it's dynamite. And again, I urge everybody to go to your website to check things out, to check rickbarker.com out, because there's so much going on there, that lots of great wisdom. And you know,
well, the first thing is they can grab a copy of my book. It's called The $150,000 Music Degree, and they'll be able to grab that. And you know, there's free video series, there's a bunch of stuff. But you know, it's one of those things, you know, Bobby, as I had reached out to you after getting your book, I'd reached out to you after seeing all the wisdom. And a lot of, you know, they always talk about people that are, you know, mentors from afar kind of situation. You've been that, because you've been able to take what you do and put it into podcast form, written form, teaching form. So it's people like you that inspire me to continue to do what it is that I do. And I'm excited to be able to share your works with my audience as well, because you're also a problem solver. And I think there's a place for us, and other problem solvers need to help other problem solvers get their word out there. So I appreciate it.
Well, likewise, Rick. Thank you very much. Anyway, thanks so much for being with me, and we'll do this again soon.
Absolutely.
To find out more about Rick, go to rickbarker.com, R-I-C-K-B-A-R-K-E-R, one word, rickbarker.com, or you can go to musicindustryblueprint.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Many, many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.